The number one thing is that people support what they help to create. So if people have voice into a process, it's much more likely to take hold. So if you've got a particular change mandate, or if you're trying to deal with an ambiguous implementation of something, a lot of organizations, for instance, are going through, how do we deal with AI integration within the organization? That particular topic is ripe for pulling folks in the room because there's not any one expert. If you can get those voices in the room to figure out together how we want to navigate this as an organization, that can really be beneficial for some of those significant change initiatives where there's high ambiguity, where there's large stakeholder involvement.
Welcome to Work Matters, where we explore what leaders can do to make work more productive, valuable, meaningful,
Patrick,
and impactful.
Welcome to the Work Matters podcast.
Your host,
Thank you. It's
Burtis.
A pleasure to be here, Thomas. Appreciate the opportunity.
So our topic is co-creation. Would you mind defining what you mean by co-creation?
Sure. I could define it with a definition, or I could give a little story, a metaphor here. I would imagine that most of your listeners are familiar with IKEA furniture. For folks who've ever put together a piece of IKEA furniture, you know that sometimes there's some literal sweat equity that goes into creating that furniture. And there are actual researchers that discovered that folks who put together that piece of furniture together actually will value that piece of furniture more highly than a premium piece of furniture with a comparable function they can buy on the open market, right? It's an interesting phenomenon. And the point being that co-creation involves creating something in community with other people. There's a whole interesting set of dynamic that comes along with that.
I guess as a leader, so you could go for the classic top-down approach, or you could pursue sort of this co-creation approach. What are some pros and cons?
The number one thing is that people support what they help to create. So if people have voice into a process, it's much more likely to take hold. So if you've got a particular change mandate, or if you're trying to deal with an ambiguous implementation of something, a lot of organizations, for instance, are going through, how do we deal with AI integration within the organization? That particular topic is ripe for pulling folks in the room because there's not any one expert. There's a lot of implications that any one person's going to have blind spots. And so if you can get those voices in the room to figure out together how we want to navigate this as an organization, that can really be beneficial for some of those significant change initiatives where there's high ambiguity, where there's large stakeholder involvement and so forth. And the other implicit question there is, where is it maybe not appropriate? I always joke that if my plane is going down, I don't want my pilots to come ask for our input. I'm expecting that they're experts in those kind of crisis situations and so forth. So that's an extreme example, but there's often a continuum of how you can think about involving folks. It's not about hand-holding and singing kumbaya, but it's really thinking ethically, how can you give people agency and give people voice into the life that they're going to have while they're working at that particular organization in that context?
So if the plane is going down, that's probably not the time for co-creation. But there are other situations, like you mentioned AI, where maybe there's not a single expert in the room that has the right answer. What are some other maybe examples where you would advise leaders to follow a co-creation model?
I would say if there's a foregone conclusion where the executive leadership wants to go, to be mindful, you don't want to do co-creation that's performative. And by that, hey, let's go through this facade and let people think they have input into the process, and then we're going to do what we want to do anyway. That will actually backfire. Now, that said, it doesn't mean that if there is a situation like that where there is a clear mandate to do X, whatever that X may be in that given context, that you can't listen or explain the rationale or provide more context to a particular decision. Co-creation is on a continuum. It's not a binary, you're co-creating or you're not. And part of co-creation is being in conversation, right? And so when you are making a policy decision involving people in that discussion, sharing the rationale and considerations, that is honoring a form of co-creation as well, just maybe not to the fullest extent of some of the options that may be available.
Yeah. The one thing I like about how you look at it is that it's really a spectrum from one person saying, this is the way we're going to do it, that's it, to it's completely open. And there probably is some blended version in between where there's a little bit of co-creation. Can you give us an example from your work where you maybe used an approach that combined elements of both?
Yeah, you know, a lot of times we work with organizations on their strategic planning initiatives, right? Our particular bias organizationally is to encourage them to take a co-creation approach to the fullest extent feasible. We do a lot of appreciative inquiry, for example, and that is rooted in some tenets of co-creation, which for those that may not be familiar, it's a strengths-based methodology in short, and it involves involving stakeholders from broad representation in whatever organizational system you may be working at. So in the context of a strategic plan, for instance, you know, we may come up with 6 to 10 different initiatives that we sort of crowdsource together collectively throughout this process. But there may be certain ones where leadership says, hey, you know, that we recognize that's important, but this particular piece we're going to handle in a different context or a different way, or there's some considerations that we're really not at liberty to share yet and so forth. And so we may inject some guardrails, if you will, to that process and say, hey, we've got these ideas, but again, we want to be as transparent as we can be and say, this particular initiative, great ideas here. We're going to table it, or we're going to deal with it in this other context here. These are the 4 or 5 for sake of this workshop here today that we want to do some collective designing on, think prototyping and so on and so forth. Again, would be a hybrid approach example that's common.
Okay. There are obviously many upsides to it, right? You give people agency, you get more buy-in. Also, in my experience, the results tend to be more sustainable.
Right.
But are there any downsides? Are there any negatives about co-creation?
I would say on the front end, it takes more work, right? You have to be much more intentional about the process you're going to follow. If you set out and wing it, that can be problematic, right? If you're not clear on what process we're going to follow and what's that going to look like and what are the various touch points and so forth. Or if you go in with a mindset, and this is related to process, but you go with the mind that we're going to allow voice and then choose to deviate from that without clear context as to why it's important to do that. So I think that's the number one thing, to think about the upfront process and planning and additional time on the front end. But to your point, while the reality is it may take a little bit longer on the front end, you tend to get that return on your investment on the back end. Because what we see in our work is very common when we take more traditional top-down approaches. Those can create a lot more friction and resistance and other collateral damage or blowback, if you will, in different ways that can take a lot of time. Now I have to clean up this policy rollout that we have. We didn't think about all these implications, or we had this great idea and we thought it was going to be a great initiative with our customer service rollout here. We had no idea about X, Y, or Z, right? Whereas if they had asked the folks who are on the front lines, they would have raised their hand and say, oh, you can't do that because of such and such, right? And so if you're not at a point where you're wanting to entertain that process, enter carefully, because you don't want to be performative.
So what kind of leadership mindset does it take? I can imagine that this can feel like a risky undertaking, right? Leaders are expected, or oftentimes think of themselves as having to have all the answers, walking into a room and say, let's all create this together. I would imagine can be a little tricky. What type of leaders do well with co-creation?
It's a great question, Thomas, and you're exactly right that is one of the areas where it can be challenging. If they're, especially in newer leaders who are less confident in the role or the context or whatever that may be, you need to be confident enough in yourself to have that humility. I don't have all the answers, nor do I need to have all the answers. And I often will tell folks that can be liberating to say that. It can be terrifying for some leaders, right, to acknowledge that. There's sort of this myth that's out there that's perpetuated by a lot of traditional top-down thinking that you got to be commanding, really confident. And there's a time and a place for that. But taken to the extreme, the reality is, and we've seen any number of examples throughout history where leaders who sort of trench themselves in and have all the answers are the ones I'm always the most skeptical of and most worried about. Don't conflate humility with indecisiveness or meekness, but an acknowledgement that, again, I don't have all the answers, that I'm going to make mistakes, that I'm going to do my best, but I'm going to get it wrong. Coming to the table with that kind of ethos and mindset to collaborate. Going back to the appreciative inquiry example, some of those process elements encourage egalitarianism. There's some tactical things that you can do in the context of conversations. Have at least a 3-to-1 ratio where you invite perspectives from at least 3 people before you insert yourself. And sometimes if there's someone who is a more dominant type of leader, we might be more explicit. Say, hey, maybe in your case, 6 or 8-to-1 ratio, just being mindful of how you're perceived and some of that power dynamic or differential.
I think it resonates very well. I remember working with a very senior person running like a big R&D function. And so they would review these projects and people would present it. And the most impactful thing that he did to make those conversations more facilitative and more interesting, quite frankly, to bring out where the risks are, was to speak last. right? Yeah. He made sure that everybody said something first. And then at the end, he would many times just summarize what had been said.
Yeah.
And I thought that was a very low-key approach to co-creation, right? Everybody felt that they had an input in this. You talked about appreciative inquiry. And I know a little bit about it, but I'm pretty sure that a lot of people have not heard about it.
Sure.
Tell us a little bit more about what that technique is.
It was David Cooperrider and Srivastava, his colleague from Case Western back in the 80s, came up with this methodology. And in short, it is looking at when organizations and individuals are at their best and coming at it from more of an abundance mindset. In other words, instead of thinking about the dysfunction of and the problems we need to fix, looking about how can we mine those, what we call root causes of success, and double down on those. Peter Drucker has a great quote, which I'll paraphrase because I don't remember the exact wording, but it basically says the essential task of good leadership is to manage strengths such that the weaknesses are irrelevant. And I love that concept. So often we focus on all these deficits and problems and everything we got to solve, and we get into the spiral negative thinking, and it just doesn't allow us to think generatively, you know, around this whole host of solutions and the color palette that Cooperrider talks about that's available to us to look at whatever it is we're trying to solve. If we think about all the times we were at our best in this particular situation, what can we learn? What insights can we draw? When were we most energized by this? When were our customers most pleased? When were our employees most engaged, et cetera? And what elements from that can we draw from? And how can we create the circumstances to cultivate those conditions more thoroughly? That's, in short, would be the essence of it.
So how can leaders get started with co-creation? Right. So how do I get started? What kind of issues might be a better fit for this than others? I would imagine that probably an organizational reorg might be difficult to approach with a co-creation mindset, but I don't know, maybe you agree, maybe you don't agree. What situations do you find that approach is more powerful, and in what situations would you advise leaders to stick with the more traditional top-down?
I want to go back to the everyday example, which you shared a moment ago, which is really powerful, right? As a leader, there's things that we can do in our everyday sort of interactions that don't have to necessarily be on a grand scale. And so the example that you cited, for instance, of a leader waiting to elicit feedback from their team before offering additional perspective is really powerful. And again, in that particular example, you want to be careful that it's not performing, I'm not doing, then I'm going to, say whatever I'm going to say anyway, right? So, The fact that in your instance, you talked about how they summarized very powerfully, and that was memorable for you, right? The research shows that leaders who do that, they engender more trust, create more psychological safety, and so forth. So there's a lot of things that we can just do in our meetings to allow for voice, allow for constructive conflict, different perspectives, summarize, being curious about things instead of being defensive, asking more questions, really asking meaningful, significant questions to drill down are really powerful ways to give voice. Is a really important part of the co-creation process. So giving voice to people and honoring their agency is an important ingredient. So I would say that those are some fundamental tenets. Now, to your point, thinking about some of the larger scale change initiatives, for instance, if you take the example of an organizational redesign, there are going to be some things that an executive leadership team, you need to make some calls, right? It doesn't, however, negate the possibility that there are going to be avenues where you can invite input into the process and conversations, and that can take different forms. One really common example that I see with some of my teams, or maybe not on the scale of a total reorg, but the concept of job crafting, which is in essence helping folks define and have agency around the margins of their core job responsibility. These are the things that we need you to do in your job and the core functions. But if you really like X and things around the margins, we want to look for opportunities to give you more opportunities to do those as well, right? So if I really like working on the customer side of things, right, I have a creative flair, right? So there might be pieces of the projects where I can get more of that, right? And so there's some really smaller scale things that folks can do. On the larger scale, having the mindset of thinking about it as a continuum is really helpful. It's not an either or. There'll be phases of the co-creation where it might be input to lead up to a large decision, and thinking about what that might look like in terms of structured conversations, in terms of survey feedback, in terms of having more of the next level leadership, for example, involved in the conversations, who have more of that input to offer, is another way to mitigate that co-creation. So it's thinking about the different levels of co-creation that are available as well.
Okay. You already touched on it a little bit, right? But what are some prerequisites or conditions for this really to work?
Yeah.
Because I can imagine that if I'm like a traditional top-down boss, and for the last 30 years, everything was like an edict from the top down.
That's going to be a challenge, right? It doesn't mean you can't start working on some of those behaviors, but I think number one, and this won't be an exhaustive list necessarily, but thinking about having a mindset that I'm wanting to do this. Again, if it's performative, it's not going to work. So don't do it for performance sake. If it's manipulative, I just want to let people think they have voice, but I'm going to do what I want anyway. That's going to backfire in a major way. So having the right mindset, having relatedly humility around how you're approaching that, having a learning mindset, a developmental mindset for yourself and for your team, an attitude of curiosity, creating the conditions for psychological safety are really important. You want folks to feel they can speak safely, they can offer contrarian points of view. Again, going back to your example you shared a moment ago, it's a really good tactical way to create psychological safety because folks realize, hey, if you do that consistently, that means Thomas really wants to hear what I have to offer here. And that's a condition where I'm going to be more inclined to say, hey, Thomas, actually, you said something in that last meeting that didn't rub me the wrong way, or I think that's maybe a little off track. I wonder if maybe we ought to look at X instead, right? And so to allow that kind of dissent or contrarian point of view is a really important element for that psychological safety as well. Having clarity of process is really important. What are the cultural norms that we establish, whether they're in those meetings or in our interactions or my one-on-ones, et cetera? Certainly when we're going through a larger formal change initiative, how are we going to do that? How are we going to communicate that? What are some of the boundaries and parameters? So those would be some certainly not exhaustive characteristics that I would offer that are really important to carrying that out.
I like that because I think, to your point, it doesn't have to be I'm a different person tomorrow. I think it's more about, I think, being open, understanding when this might present an opportunity, right, to generate the buy-in that like change initiatives oftentimes need to be successful. But I also like your point about clear rules and clarity of process. I guess that's probably where a lot of people struggle, right? If you never tried this before, if you're not used to this.
It's a skill to learn. It's anxiety provoking when it's like, I don't have all the answers, or I feel like we're maybe getting off track. I had an idea how this meeting or this conversation was going, but now I feel like it's getting derailed. To be able to take a breath in those moments and say, this is okay. This is healthy. Acknowledge that. Give time and space for that. That was one of the things that I neglected. Experience has taught me that over the years, but early on, I didn't build enough time and space for people to live with decisions appropriately or to process decisions and to have that dialogue. And one of my executive coaching clients often talks about her challenge for herself is I want to lean into conflict, right? I lean into those areas of disagreement instead of feeling I got to run away from it. Conflict is not inherently bad. Adam Grant will often say, in fact, if you don't have conflict, the absence of conflict is not harmony, as he'll say. It's apathy, right? So you want to have that healthy, constructive, respectful conflict, giving appropriate time and space for that is really an important piece. And that's one that's often missed because we just underestimate people's emotions and reactions and giving time and space for that.
It also sounds like that the key impediment is kind of like within the leader, right? If you have a very high need for control, this must feel very uncomfortable.
Yeah.
So it's going to require a certain type of leader. And even then, it's still going to be a little nebulous, a little uncomfortable, but I guess that's part of the process.
It's part of the process. And I think you're exactly right. It starts with the leadership, but also you may have other folks that are more skeptical or more resistant and don't want to throw wrenches into whatever process you're establishing. So it'd be important to manage those conversations and walk with those folks in appropriate ways as well.
You've done this a lot. What's the most audacious example for co-creation that you've seen where you're like, I didn't think that this would work?
That's a great question. I'm trying to think of, we've done a lot of the strategic initiatives for large change mandates. I've had organizations where the personalities of different groups, so this is never going to fly. And they were so siloed and so entrenched. And so for me, it's often not so much the change initiative itself, but it's the fact that we got these particular groups to work together in a constructive way, and they actually were energized by that. It never ceases to amaze me. These two groups who were at odds, we actually got them to work together in very healthy, constructive ways to get rowing in the same direction because they had a lot of care for whatever that change initiative they were working on. What's been the biggest challenge or surprise? It's usually always been that interpersonal stuff that we've had to work through individually or within the organizations.
As I was listening to you, I was thinking about my own experience with co-creation and where it worked and where it didn't work.
I'd be curious if you encountered one in that particular example that comes to mind for you.
I do. It's a really dumb idea to try to agree on a logo by co-creation. That's one thing I found incredibly frustrating. So I can see that people oftentimes have good intentions. They want to invite people into the process, but you can also make a mistake, right? You can pick the wrong topic. You can pick something. It's just not suitable for co-creation.
Yeah. I laugh because group writing or editing is another one I put in that category. Delegating to either a particular individual or in many cases to a task force for a particular task can be done effectively. That is co-creating, right? Recognizing that this is not something we're going to decide by a committee of 200 here, right? But if we get key representatives from these different stakeholder perspectives who we know are going to effectively communicate and represent that perspective, and we task them and give them the authority to carry that task, and then there can be different approval mechanisms depending on the nature of that decision, that is still a form of co-creation versus just having one particular leader make a call and say, this is the way it's going to be. Again, it comes back to thinking about what your process is. There's many ways to scale that co-creation model depending on what you're trying to accomplish.
There's also like an element of sense-making.
Right? Exactly right.
And so again, it's like the leaders make the decision by themselves. They're internally reconcile themselves. So for them, the world makes sense.
Yeah.
And they got it all figured out. But the conflict then comes in when they rule that out and everybody has a different mental model.
Doesn't make sense to me, right? Makes sense to you, Taz, but I have no idea where you came up with that idea, right?
You thought about it for 6 months. I thought about it for 6 minutes. Exactly. We're going to be on different pages. So I think the real power, I guess, for me lies in that we got everybody together making sense at the same time. And if you can manage that process to the end, that's really powerful because
very
you not only
so.
Have maybe a better answer, but you also have a sense of alignment that we're all bought into this, that we all have a stake in it, but it's hopefully also like a more powerful solution.
And it becomes part of your cultural ethos. You pick something that people care about and you have them co-created in a constructive way. And that becomes that cultural experience. You create that sense-making together.
If we want to encourage leaders to move down the road of co-creation, what are the two or three things that they can do right now?
Start small. And I would say that could be in the context of your everyday meetings, thinking about how you're approaching the meetings, asking more questions, seeking more to understand than to be understood, being really creative or curious rather, trying to seek to draw people's perspectives. And being comfortable with ambiguity. You don't have to have all the answers in the moment, but you also don't have to feel pressure to respond in the moment. So thinking about, hey, Thomas, that perspective share, really insightful. And it's given me a lot of food for thought. Let me chew on this for a little bit. Let's come back and talk about it because I honestly hadn't thought about that. So that comes with the humility. So thinking about what are those little tackle things we can do in our everyday conversations. I would start there if you haven't already worked that muscle. Larger scale, thinking about what are some ways that I can involve, give opportunity for voice and agency into that process. How can I set that up? There's certainly any number of folks professionally who can help walk alongside you depending on the nature of that initiative. It's one of our core areas of work, for instance. There are many other very qualified folks out there in industry who you can engage for that. If there's something that you have a particular initiative that you know is going to be more challenging, more complex, et cetera. But I always like to start with those. What are those everyday things that we can do? And it starts with being okay without having all the answers and being really curious and being comfortable in those moments of silence or conflict or ambiguity, fill in the blank there, and recognizing that done well, there's great credibility and authority that you can build with your team by demonstrating that style of leadership.
Yeah, I can also imagine, again, that's probably right, the reason why you have a business. It's not an easy task. You got to be very clear about how you design the process.
For
you got to be clear about the ground rules. You also have to figure out how you manage your team because you might have some people that are very loud, suck all the air out of the room, but don't contribute much, whereas others that you want to hear from sitting on the sidelines. So in addition to you're going to have to make this an exclusive process and listen to people and ask questions, you probably also have to be a little bit of an air traffic controller to make sure that everybody has a chance to participate equally so that it doesn't go off the rails.
Yep, you're exactly right.
Wonderful. So listen, you're in the process of publishing a book.
Tell us
what that's all about.
So the book is entitled The Intentional Executive. It's a purpose-driven playbook to transform your leadership, your team, and your results. And it talks about this along with other related concepts. How can you be a more intentional leader to do exactly these kinds of things? And from the everyday to the larger scale considerations, our mission at Etherington Group is to help the individuals and the organizations they serve flourish. The impact we want to make in the world is helping them to be successful in whatever endeavors they're undertaking.
Good. So when is the book going to hit the bookshelf?
Soon. We're working on the final touches here. Hopefully within the next month or so, folks can go to our website. We'll have a page up for that. We're at adlucemgroup.com, A-D-L-U-C-E-M-G-R-O-U-P. Adlucem is Latin for to the light. And they can certainly connect with me on LinkedIn as well. We put a lot of individual and team exercises in there. It's very rooted in research and our own executive experience with my co-author, Dr. Melissa Norcross, but it's also very practitioner oriented. Both of us are practitioners and we've been in industry for decades and we've seen what works and what doesn't work. And we've tried to create some very helpful playbooks and tools that individuals and teams can apply in their own context.
Wonderful. So we're going to put all of that into the show notes in case people struggle with the Latin and the spelling. Like me, I have forgotten most of my Latin. But we'll put that in the show notes so it's easy for people to find out more about you, your book, and connect with you. Listen, Patrick, I've really enjoyed our conversation.
Absolute
I'm a huge
pleasure.
Fan of co-creation, and I'm glad to see that there are other people that have the same belief. And I've seen the power of this, so I can only encourage our listeners to take advantage of what you have to offer and give co-creation a try. And as you said, but it doesn't have to be all or nothing, right? You can gently ease your way into that. Really important topic. Thank you so much for coming on the show.
My pleasure. Thank you, Thomas.
We hope you enjoyed this discussion. If you did, be sure to subscribe, like, share, or comment. Until next time, let's make work matter. Yes,